Okay, last class we just it was just some discussion that before we even started the class about Purim Suda. So then there was in the chat, so we started speaking about it again, and I mentioned that I asked the Posek and Rav Abadi, and he wasn't sure whether you had to have bread. I've now learned that he wasn't sure, not because he didn't know. There's different views on each side, so I guess he didn't know which side to paskin. So I thank Eli, Rabbi Mordechai, a bunch of you sent me that it's a big machokes. The Magen Avraham and the Chidah say you don't have to have it. Others say you do have to. The Chafetz Chaim Mishnah Berurah doesn't say one way or the other. I wonder, by the way, if the people who say that you do need bread, because that's what a suda is, if they would say it if they were alive today, for the simple reason that bread used to be part of a meal. Sometimes when I go to Haredim to eat, they always, like, even though during the week, they'll say, here, let us wash. And it's so strange because in my world, other than Shabbos and Yom Tov, you don't wash. Thanksgiving, we sit down for a big formal dinner. It always feels weird because you expect that there'd be washing and Kiddush, and there isn't. But we don't. We go out to restaurants. We don't wash. I was just at a wedding, not yesterday, a week ago, at the Marina Del Rey. Some of you probably know it in the Bronx. 600 people, not a mask in sight. So you know that in America, we're in a different stage. But so no one washes. So in a time where bread is not considered essential and we have other carbohydrates, it's hard to see, since there's no Lechem Mishnah, why it's essential. But, you know, whatever you do, I don't think it's such a big deal. You wash, you don't wash. It's really not a major thing. You have authorities on either side. But since we're getting close to Purim, I'll say it again what I said last year, because we have all these new people listening to us. So here's something that does matter. And I guarantee you, almost guarantee, I can say that odds are that if you go to an Ashkenazic shul, they'll do it wrong. So those who were with me last year remember this, but we have lots and lots of new people, at least double the amount of people listening. So I will say it again. Let me pull it up here. Here you go. You'll listen in reading the Megillah. Pay attention. When they get to the sixth pasuk, you'll hear it. The Baal Kori in an Ashkenazic shul, Sfaradim always get it right. He'll read Mitos Sahav Vachesef Al, and mark my word, almost guaranteed, he'll say Al Ritzpat Vahat Vashesh. And that changes the meaning of the word. It's Ritzpah in biblical Hebrew means hot coals. You have the verse in Yishayahu. The word is Ritzfat, and actually it's supposed to be a Shvana, as you see indicated. Ritzefat. Now, if he makes the mistake, as they routinely do, the post game that I've seen say you don't need to repeat it, because today we assume Ritzpah also means floor, but it's a mistake. And really, it should be corrected beforehand, tell the person, because it's almost impossible. I don't see how you can correct someone, Megillas Esther. I've never seen it done, because they all know it, then it'll be too embarrassing. So my suggestion is you speak to the Baal Kori ahead of time, or you tell the rabbi. The rabbi knows. The rabbi Meishel actually knows. Not because I told him. He had already spoken to the Baal Kori about this. So there you go. So we have a few weeks still to worry about that. Okay, another thing. Sometimes when I'm speaking here, I get the comments, the private chats. And, you know, it's hard for me. Sometimes I'll regal achas to respond. So sometimes I concede. And then as soon as class is over, I realize I shouldn't have conceded. And, last week was one of them. And, I said nivopeh, and we'll see why I said that later. We'll get back to that issue. And I said, but technically it should be nibulpeh. So someone, texted me that, it's with a vav, not a bet. So, you know, I didn't have time to think on my toes, so I said, okay, I'll accept it, but I shouldn't have conceded, because no, it actually is with Hello. A bet. Not only is it with a bet, hold on a second, let me show you here. It's even in the Gemara, the wording. Here you see in Shabbos 33a, they don't use the term nibul, but they say navutpeh, but you can see it's the bet. And you can look at any dictionary. It's a bet. The word's a bet. And a regular achas. I couldn't remember, so I conceded. Now, it is true that if you look at some more recent sources, I've seen that they do. I Googled it. So at Otzer Chachma, I Googled it in Otzer Chachma. Out of thousands and thousands of sources, you get in the tens with a vav, because it's a mistake, though, because people say nivul, as opposed to nivul, and that's maybe that's from Yiddish or just a mistake. You know, it's funny, the word nivul with a vav and nivul, I really mean the same thing. But so it's become accepted to pronounce it incorrectly, and therefore people are starting to write it incorrectly. But 100% it's with a bet. However, I did say that I'll give you some other examples of where, because of the mispronunciation, it's created problems. So let me give you just a couple of examples of this, of what I meant by that. Get back here to the screen. Here's one of the most famous ones, about the bracha we make at a wedding. So what does the Shulchan Aruch say? You say, Asher kishonim v'sonim aharayos, svardek aharayot, v'asar lanu harusot, hitir lanu hanesuot, al yedei chupa, v'kidushin, with a bet, without a dagesh, because it's after chupa, brachat Hashem HaKadosh Yisrael. Now, the Ramah says that the bracha should be chupa, and then with a vav, v'kidushin, with a vav. Now, which one is it? Plenty of Rishonim say it's with a bet, and that it's a mistake that it's with a vav, but it's the people, they heard it so often, chupa v'kidushin, with a vet, that they assume it's with a vav. The Ritva says, and others say, no, it is with a vav. So that's the distinction, Ashkenazim is Sephardim, and I'm not sure if it's a mistake. The Ritva says it's not a mistake, but many say it is a mistake. I also mentioned Rav David Cohen in his book, the Kovel Mishar. He says, Kovel Mishar, he says, he gives a page 11. He gives a number of examples of this where you see that there's a mistake. The copyist was listening to someone read it, and then he misheard what was said, or he heard correctly, but it was the wrong letter. And he gives examples where, for example, you have in Rashi, quotes in Zvachim, the word Pesach appears, Pesamechet, and it should be Pesach with a Sof. But the person copying it was heard it, and he wrote it down. He gives another good example. This is great. In Rashi and Sanhedrin, where Rashi says, Ezo Tova, but it shouldn't be Tova with a tet. It should be with a tuf, Teva. So what is that? That's the Lithuanian pronunciation. Tova is Teva. And so that's, he gives good examples of that. This idea of Pesach, it has been suggested, I don't know if this is correct, that the name Pesach, people are named Pesach. Isn't that a strange name? You're not going to name someone Sukkot. You're not going to name someone Shavuos. Someone's named Pesach. Why is it named Pesach? And we have this name already, even going back to medieval times. Why did you name Pesach? So they say, if you look online, I looked earlier today, said when someone's born on Pesach, they gave him the name. I don't know. What? So if you're born on Sukkot, your name's Sukkot? Whoever. This is like an ex post facto justification. Now, I don't know if I'm going to tell you is correct, but this has been suggested in traditional sources, that the name is really Pesachia. Pesaf, and that's a Tanakh name, Yud-Het, Yud-Hei, and the Yud-Hei dropped off, and it was Pesach, and then it became Pesach with a sin, with a Samech, as opposed to a Saf. So again, I don't know if that's where it comes from, but it does make a little bit of sense that it would be Pesachia. And you don't want to say God's name at the end, so then it became Pesach, and then and that just became by listening it. We know that, for example, you look at the word Sota, we spell it with a Samech, and yet plenty of people spell it with a Sin. It became, they became interchangeable. So maybe, and I hope I'm not offending anyone with the name Pesach, it's a very good name, with C. Pesach Frank, in Camp Morasha in the 70s, a very popular teacher, Rabbi Pesach Oratz. If anyone went to Stern, you probably remember Rabbi Oratz, and he taught at Morasha. He actually recommended to my parents after high school, I go to the Mir Yeshiva. And because I was actually a learner in camp. But But it's a good name, Pesach, but is it an authentic name, or has it become, it's like my name, Melech, which a lot of people think it's Elimelech. It's not. Where'd you get the name Elimelech from, though? That's until Elimelech of Lezhensk, no one was named Elimelech. We have no record of anyone being named Elimelech. So that's actually not my name, but people think it is. So names could come about for interesting reasons. Okay, I want to. I do have some other things, but I will get to that. If 1 week I get the questions stop coming in as much as they are, I'll get to the things I still want to get to about violating Shabbos. Wait to hear what from the Gra, the Vilna Gaon, and Reb Chaim. But I want to return because we have a lot to do to Rabbi Shaul Berlin. Oh, you know, in Meyer's book. I looked at it again on page 11. He says what I told you. He says that the community, the dispute between Emden and Eibschitz with the writs of excommunication, so divided the community that it was less able to oppose new ideas in its midst, etc. So you see already the Emden Eibschitz dispute, the breakdown of rabbinic authority is leading the way to reform, is mentioned by Meyer, but it's mentioned by earlier sources. As well. As I said, I think it's Shaul. If you recall, we ended last when we were dealing with the Summim Rosh, and I mentioned how in the first tshuva we looked at, where he's talking about the person who occasionally says heresy, that's okay. It's not so bad, I should say. You don't have to worry about the Megillah. But the one who does it continuously, and the words he uses, ve'eno maksha atzmo, but just consistently say this stuff. And I said that I couldn't help but thinking that this is an allusion to a sexual matter. And I said that I looked, and I never found a usage of it in the Rishonim like this. Well, I looked again after class on Otsar HaChachma, and I did not find any Rishonim that used the word in that way. What I did find, why I knew this already, and I'm not 100% sure I'm correct in attributing to Shaul Berlin this underhanded thing, but there is another expression that it's in Moed Katan 16b. It's a drash. They're referring to King David, and they say about him that when he learned Torah, Hayem Adenat Smo Katoat, they derive it from the word adino, that he would, I'll just read it in English, he would make himself soft as a worm. When you go to war, he would make himself hard and strong as a tree. I'm assuming that also is not an illusion, because I don't think the rabbis were doing that. But you do have this usage, but among the Rishonim, I didn't find it. And so I'm not 100% sure. Nachum Shmaryahu emails me, he's not sure either whether it's the same insinuation, but he does point to Rav Yaakov Emden, believe it or not. Rav Yaakov Emden in Shelas Yavetz, volume 1, number 171, in speaking about a Mila issue, he actually uses the language as well. He says that he's talking about someone who opposes the opinion, doesn't listen. He's stubborn. He says, "Umaksha atzmo ledat acherim." So it does seem to be here that he's also that clearly Rav Yaakov Emden is playing around with the expression. And we know Rav Yaakov Emden had some strange ways about these matters. But I don't know if I'm wrong in accusing Shaul Berlin of underhandedly putting in a risque reference. Then I apologize to him. But he's already in God's bad graces for all the other things he did that we don't need to worry about that one. I want to look the one final tshuva of Shaul Berlin to show you his subversive nature, his attempts to undermine traditional Judaism. And that's number 301. If you look in the Besamim Rosh, number 301, it's not by the Rosh. This is by an individual named Yaakov ben Machir. So who is Yaakov ben Machir? Well, the Kasa de Harsana. That, by the way, that's the name of the commentary, Shabbat, and it means like a fried fish or something. But the Kasa de Harsana tells you, he says, I don't recall such a person ever being mentioned except for one place in the response of the Rosh Bo. So that's what Shaul Berlin did when he comes up with these names, like the person who supposedly put it together, Yitzhak de Molina. He's mentioned one time in the response of the Beit Yosef. So you have the Arishon, Yaakov ben Machir, who's we don't know anything about. He's mentioned one time. But Shaul Berlin pulls out a name like this and throws it in to the responsa. So let me summarize what this responsa is about. And I'll use Jacob's. He gives a very good summary. He was asked, he deals with, we know that for three matters, the three big ones, one martyrs oneself, or luckily one's supposed to martyr oneself, then violate the sin. Murder, certain sexual immoralities, and idolatry, if someone says worship that idol. And Jews in medieval times allowed themselves to be martyred. And we come to Spain this summer and Portugal. We'll talk about this big problem. Why is it that in France and why is it that in England and in Germany, Jews allow themselves to be martyred by the thousands? And yet when you go to Spain and also Portugal, yes, there were Jews who allowed themselves, they didn't really have to deal with someone. Well, 1391, there really was some martyrdom, and many of them left when they were expelled. But thousands and thousands and tens of thousands and more converted in a way you don't see in the Ashkenazic lands. So we will get involved in that. But in this tshuva, the sage in quotes, raises doubts as to whether there's a concept of martyrdom. Why? And remember, these are the most fundamental, eternally binding halachot of martyrdom, of not acknowledging idolatry. What Yaakov ben Machir, in quotes, states is that there is no longer an obligation for martyrdom when it comes to idolatry or adultery. With murder, there is, because you can't kill someone else to save your own life. So but if it's just an idolatry, what Jews killed them, allowed themselves to be killed for, killed their children for even, so as not to be forced to convert. Yaakov ben Machir says, we no longer have a Sanhedrin today. Since we don't have a Sanhedrin, we don't have issue, we can't decide questions of dinei nefashos. That's what it's called. Matters of life and death. We don't have a Sanhedrin, so we can't execute people. So Yaakov ben Machir says that the ruling that you have to martyr yourself, that's the ruling of, like the equivalent of ruling of a Sanhedrin. And we don't have a Sanhedrin today, so therefore there can't be any dinei nefashos. It's a life and death ruling that only a Sanhedrin can rule. And therefore, since we don't have a Sanhedrin, you don't martyr yourself. And then he says, in addition to that, there's so many sveikot. Every Torah matter you come to, there's machlokas. So there's always going to be disputes. And since there are so many sveikos, and so much disputes, there's always going to be a doubt about something, so you never have to martyr yourself because you can always find some suffix. So he gives two reasons why there should never be a reason to martyr yourself. Now, from an enlightened 18th century perspective, this all makes perfect sense because human life is the most important thing. The idea that you would give up your life for a religion, that doesn't make any sense. Sort of like today, no one would say that makes sense. And to say that, this is dinei nefashos, and since we don't have a Sanhedrin, there's no idea of martyrdom. Who ever heard of such a thing? It's the Minchas Elazar, Rav Chaim Elazar Shapiro, the Munkacher, no relation to me. He's such a kanoi, such an extremist. I don't know if I take it as a sign of pride if I was related to him. It's like being related to the Satmar Rebbe. I think I would, but I mean, some of his ideas, the Minchas Elazar's ideas, are so wacko and so outlandish. He even hated Agudas Yisrael. He said about Daf Yomi. He said, "What a joke Daf Yomi is." They stop in the middle of a sugya and they say, "Oh, it's a daf. We're ended." He said the whole idea of Daf Yomi is only to bring, it's all political. It's to bring people into Agudas Yisrael's tents. And yet he was the closest of friends to Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg, who they were so foreign from one another. Once Rabbi Weinberg said that he knows the Munkacher Rebbe doesn't have Ruach HaKodesh, because the Munkacher Rebbe was telling all of his Hasidim, when Rabbi Weinberg comes to Berlin, the video is online. The video of the great Munkacher wedding is online. in which you see, by the way, that Munkat was not all Hasidic. You see the videos there of all the kids singing Hatikva with a different words, by the way. They had everything. They had Mizrahi. They had irreligious in Munkat. But, and you see the wedding scene also. And Rabbi Weinberg, you see him in the picture for a quarter of a second. So when everyone wanted to know why the Hasidim and the Munkatcher, why the Munkatcher was giving such a kavod, he put him under the chuppah, standing there, this rabbiner doctor, and he gave him such kavod. The Munkatcher said to them that Rabbi Weinberg only studies secular subjects in the bathroom. So Rabbi Weinberg said, from this I know that the Rebbe doesn't have Ruach HaKodesh, because he said that, because he could say about me that I only study secular subjects in the, in those days they call it Beit HaKisei, I guess. So the Munkatcher, he's such a fascinating figure. We should do classes on him. He attacks this tshuva, and he points out so correctly that the lack of a Sanhedrin only means that we don't have court cases where the Sanhedrin rules that someone is deserving of the death penalty. But where and when you have to suffer martyrdom has nothing to do with the Sanhedrin. It's not a question of dinei nefashos. It's simply a religious question. It's no different than Yom Kippur. Do you have to eat or not on Yom Kippur? I mean, it's a totally religious question. And the fact that the B'Samim Rosh was trying to put this in to undermine, again, the whole idea of martyrdom. Now, B'Samim Rosh has to deal with a big problem, and he takes it up. Well, you look in medieval times, we see that all the Jews did allow themselves to be killed, did suffer martyrdom. So what's that about? So B'Samim Rosh says, well, there was no legal obligation for them to do that, but they did it anyway. Why did they do it anyway? Because they saw their lives as having no significance among the Gentiles. That is, halachically, they were allowed to convert to Christianity. But how can a Yid live among the Goyim? You know, that's... So they allow themselves to be killed because for a Jew to live among the Goyim, that's pasnished. It's not a good life. And the Minchas Elazar says that on the surface, you might think this is a good thing. Because after all, these people are not obligated to give up their lives, but they give up their lives anyway so as not to live among the Christians. But the Minchas Elazar says that no, this is actually the most dangerous at all. Because what he's saying is that there's no halacha, there's no mitzvah for martyrdom. And when they martyred themselves in medieval times, why did they do it? Just to preserve their separateness, their ethnic uniqueness. They substituted religious reason for martyrdom with a national reason, with a social reason. And the Minchas Elazar says, just as the Tzionim do in our day. What's the most important thing? The fact that we're a nation. So since the Jews couldn't feel comfortable living among the Christians, they accepted martyrdom because that's an ethnic reason. And that's, the Minchas Elazar says, that's what the Zionists do. No longer is religion the reason for our life, rather, that why we exist as a people. Not the Torah, like Rasad Yagon said, that there are the Jewish people are people because of the Torah. No, it's all about our ethnic identification. And the Minchas Elazar is, of course, correct. He rarely is incorrect. He's incorrect when he says about the Rambam some stuff, that the Rambam's rationalist things are only said to find favor with the Haskalah-oriented types, but he didn't really believe this stuff. But generally, the Minchas Elazar had such a strong intellect and such a critical sense, and he saw clearly right through this B'Samim Rosh. We could spend more time on the B'Samim Rosh. There's a number of other tshuvot, but I think you get the point that this is a proto-reform, or maybe in addition to reform, a nihilistic attempt to tear down traditional Judaism from the inside through the ruse of attributing it to an early sage. Every time we have these forgeries, we have to ask ourselves why it's done. So we have forgeries, anti-Zionist forgeries, you have all sorts of forgeries. And usually there's a reason. Usually it's not just someone having fun at everyone else's expense. I have to tell you, by the way, and I'm going to write about this in my next post, an earthquake landed in the last few weeks on academic Jewish scholarship and also on traditional Jewish scholarship, in that a book appeared by a Haredi guy, but a guy who knows scholarship. He's the son of Rav Yaakov Moshe Hillel, the Baghdad, not the, well, he's Baghdadi, but he's from India. He's a big Makubo. You can see him on YouTube also in English. He comes from England, and he comes from India, went to England, started at Gateshead. But he's one of the top Kabbalists in Jerusalem, and also he's a posek, and he's written many things. He even has a book called Tamim Tiyeh, a very nice book I have, which is against all this practical Kabbalah. But his son is a real, he's like one of these, well, he is one of these Haredi academic scholars. He came out with a book in which he claims and provides lots of proof that Rabbi Yaakov Moshe Toledano, Yaakov Moshe Toledano was chief rabbi of Tel Aviv. Before that, he was in Alexandria, Egypt. He then was minister of religion. He's a posek, but he's also a scholar, published lots of stuff. I wanted to do classes on him. He claims that loads and loads of texts that Yaakov Moshe Toledano said he had, because he was a collector. The JTS has many of his stuff. Collected many of his archives, as I recall, manuscripts, that a lot of these manuscripts are forgeries. Now, so much of modern scholarship on the Middle East, the medieval Middle East is based on, or a lot of it, I should say, is based on stuff that Toledano published. He even published stuff relating to the family of the Rambam, that if this is true, that he was a forger. Now, you're talking about a posek here. You're talking about a rav of communities, a well-respected Rav Avad Yosef gives him such kavod. He was a very popular Sephardic rabbi. He lost out to Rav Nissim to be chief rabbi of the state of Israel. If he was a forger, that I can't explain. I mean, this is, I haven't made a judgment on it yet because I haven't studied it carefully, but we spoke a couple semesters ago about Zvi Hirsch Auerbach, and there's other examples, but I mean, this is going to, as I said, it's an earthquake. So what else can I tell you about Shaul Berlin? Well, he dies in London. You have an article here by Rabbi Raymond Apple, Englishman who ended up for many years in Australia. He has an article here about the heretical rabbi, Shaul Berlin, and he points out something very interesting. Well, first, as I said, Shaul Berlin dies in London, and he's buried in the cemetery there. Here he has a Hebrew tombstone and also an English tombstone. I'll read you what the Hebrew tombstone says in a second. I have to say, when I was in London, he's buried in East End in the old cemetery. Was his first, the Sephardim used that cemetery. They told me they would open it specially for me, and I didn't take pictures because I remember seeing images online, and now I can't remember if the Hebrew text of the tombstone that I'm going to read you still exists. I have a text here from a sefer from the early 20th century, and I think he might be copying it from earlier. Everywhere I look online, all I get is this this image that this the tombstone of Rabbi Shaul Berlin, so son of Hart Lion, chief rabbi at C11, who was the also rabbi in London. And so I don't know whether the Hebrew text, I mean, it's not so simple to say I go back to London and just go there because the cemetery is closed. You have to get special permission to have it open for you. So if anyone in London knows about this, if you can tell me, let me know. But in here, he says something strange, that in London, they used to recite at the Great Synagogue, and then it was printed in the Adler, the Rutledge Machzor, the different, they would commemorate the early rabbis in on Yisker prayers when they had the Chagim. And one of the people who they mentioned was none other than Shaul Berlin. And he just says, he just mentions that, and he says you cannot defend the inclusion of his name together with the august company of the rabbis of the Great Synagogue. I will tell you how his name got in there. This I have no doubt, and the answer is clear. He dies in 1794, but his brother becomes chief rabbi of London, United Synagogue, Salman Herschel, or Herschel, I think it's pronounced Herschel, actually, in 1802. So there's no question that Salman Herschel put up the tombs, put up the Matseva. In fact, the Matseva says as follows. You can find this in the book Yechabed Av by Moshe Menachem Walden. It mentions the original Matseva calls him Marina Rav Shalzatzal, Ben Marina Rabbeinu, et cetera, Tzvi Hirsch, Av Beis Din of Berlin. And then it says the brother of Shlomo, Marina Rav Shlomo, Av Beis Din of Kilosenu. So he's saying it's the, so he dies in London. He's buried. I don't know what type of tombstone he had. His brother becomes rabbi in London. His brother puts up a tombstone for him, a nice mechubadik, honorable tombstone. And then it must be his brother stuck his name in among the people they remember at the Yort sites. There's a, so he's buried together with all the big, you know, and he's buried next to some big rabbis. Zerubbabel Tevel Schiff is there. There is a rumor that he committed suicide. I can't say whether it's true. It's an oral tradition that is mentioned, but if you look in Nesson Zvi Friedman's Otzer HaRabbanim, he records it, and then when he was challenged by this, he said it's a tradition. So who knows? And that is it with Shaul Berlin. Any questions? I'll get back to that later. I just see someone asks that the Besayim Rosh had proto-reform ideas. Did he have any significant influence? No, he had no significant influence. He had some of his tshuvot had influence, but not the radical ones I mentioned, not the crazy ones. Some of the other tshuvot are mentioned, and they had some influence. He had no communal influence or anything like that. And the tshuvot we've read have all been regarded as outliers. Even people who generally accept the Besayim Rosh see those tshuvot as problematic, and you can look in the book I have, the Besamim Rosh, in the back. He mentions some people who refer to them, but no one adopts this halachic argument that there's no idea of martyrdom anymore. That totally overturns 2,000 years of halacha. No one ever said such a thing, and no one ever said the other things we mentioned. Okay, so let us move on. We're now at the end of, so Shaul Berlin, he tried his best and he failed, but others will succeed. At the end of the 19th century, you have, end of the 18th century, you have proponents of Jewish educational reform, not yet religious reform. That's going to come soon. But they were interested in more than just expanding the curriculum to make room for secular studies, of which there was. They wanted the Jewish tradition to be conveyed in a way different than what had been done. How it had been conveyed? By cheder, and the old way of doing things. They wanted Judaism to be a modern religion. So what makes it modern? So for instance, a catechism. Every good Christian knows you have a catechism summarizing in good form what you have to believe. And this allows you to distinguish the essence of the faith from those things that are unimportant. So these educational reformers at the end of the 18th century begin putting out catechisms. And you have a number of these catechisms in the late 18th century, often modeled on Maimonides' 13 principles, even if they don't follow exactly what he says, but that sort of model. And the focus is always on belief, not halacha. The Maskilim, and that's what they were. We're not dealing with reformers yet. We're dealing with Maskilim, but Maskilim very soon merge into reformers. They begin to see the synagogue in a new light. The synagogue is not just a place where you go to fulfill your obligations to daven. They're looking at what's going on in the churches, especially the Protestant churches, and they're saying, well, the synagogue should now be a place where prayer could affect the spirit of the worshiper, where you leave synagogue a different person. Prayer is a subjective experience that leaves you a different person. Now, it's true that you can find Jews today that speak about this, people influenced by Hasidut, Neo-Hasidut, and there's nothing wrong with it. But that's not how Jews spoke in the 18th century. Jews spoke about, we got a daven, and that's what it is. In fact, if you go to the Sephardic community, you don't say what time is davening. You don't say we got to go daven now. They use the word prayer. We have to go pray. And if you're an Ashkenazi, it always sounds strange because like we don't pray. That's what Christians do. We daven. But prayer was, and this might be one of the examples of where the Maskilim and then the earlier reformers were onto something that traditional Jews were lacking. Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch is honest enough to acknowledge that there are things that traditional Judaism is lacking, and it's Dafka the reformers that are going to call attention to some of the lacuna, not because they invented it, but because this is part of traditional Judaism. But in all these years in the ghetto, we overlooked it, we forgot about it, and therefore, if we then start adopting certain of these things, it's not because the reformers, it's only because, though, they've reminded us of what we forgot, just like non-Jews can remind us of our obligations. But the Maskilim said that prayer needs to be a spiritual experience. Problem with this is, spiritual experience. Once a week, maybe it can be a spiritual experience. If you're going three times a day, it's hard for it to be a spiritual experience. That's just life. Rav Isher Zalman Meltzer said about Rav Kook that his mincha on a weekday is more spiritual than our ne'ilah. But I mean, that's Rav Kook. So it was this type of thought that was very popular in the late 18th century. If Judaism were to be a religion like other religions, then the synagogue would have to be for Jews like the church was for the Christians, namely the focus of religious life. But we know that synagogue attendance is declining in the 18th century. Many Jews were not Shomer Shabbos. They were Jews, but they used Shabbos for secular pursuits. Others, we know, visited the churches, and they found the churches inspiring. First of all, you have instrumental music. That's got to be inspiring, instrumental music. They had a sermon. There were no sermons in the 18th century in Ashkenazic shuls. Here you have a sermon which serves to uplift the people, to speak to them about values and spirituality. And there's a cantor who's you together with the muse, not the traditional cantor, but using the music and a choir. You see all these things. They didn't call it a cantor, the person doing the hymns, whatever they did in the church. So this influence them, and you start having these people writing in the late 18th century that we have to remake the synagogue so it speaks to us. I want to stress this again. There were no sermons. The genre of a sermon does not exist in the 18th century. You have drushas, but a drusha is not a sermon. The sermon leaves you, is supposed to uplift you, supposed to touch your soul and make you a better person and connect you with spiritual things. As I said, we take it for granted today because our synagogues all have them Shabbos morning. But this comes, if we get to the Shem Shem for Hirsch, we'll see. He's one of the first to say that this is something we can use and there's nothing wrong with this. So they see all this. Also, they write about how they're impressed with the decorum. You go into a shtiebel, there's lots of noise going on. Kids are running up and down. Now, we could say correctly, well, the kids feel at home there. That's why they act like this. It's like when they go to the grandparents and they can run around and be excited versus they go to them when the relative where they can't go in a certain room and there's the plastic on the couches and all that. You know which one they prefer. So, the churches, even to this day, I work at a Catholic university. I speak to the students. The synagogue is much more homey. The church they visit once a week, if that. And so everything, you treat it like you're a guest. But the shul is like a home. But and visitors who visited the synagogue describe non-Jews how could this be a place of worship of God? Because we all know a shul is not just worship; it's everything. We learn there, and we see our friends there. It's before Mordechai Kaplan came around, it was the center. It was our Jewish center. But these maskilim, they're once a week Jews, if that. That's putting it. They usually don't even go at all once a week. But they want this. They want it to be dignified. And they're looking at the church and they're seeing the, and it's true, the Maskilim had a point when they say that in the shul, that business matters and gossip was going on. The more things change, the more they stay the same. You go to any one of our shuls, you'll see the same thing. But, we have a longer service. We have Torah reading and we have aliyahs and sometimes Misha Beras that go on. So people talk. That's just that this isn't something new. This has been going on from time immemorial. But if you go to a short service and it's like a church sort of service, you don't do that. It's just a different approach. But they didn't see the shul as dignified. So the language was a problem. in the Protestant church, it would be in German. The Catholic church, you couldn't make this argument what they're going to make, because it's in Latin. But the people didn't speak Hebrew anymore. If they could read it, they couldn't understand what they were reading. You go into the Lutheran church there, you understand what you're saying. So by the 18th century, we find the liturgy being translated into modern German. The service is still in Hebrew, but it's being translated into German. Now, we previously had translations into Yiddish, Judeo-German, mostly for the women, but then even for the men, it became useful because the younger generation was more at home in German, and not just in German, in German characters. So educational, now synagogue reformers, before there's a reform movement, are saying we need to have parts of the liturgy, not all of it, but parts in German. We need to have a sermon in German. During this period, the Masculine period, they started speaking about abolishing Piyutim. We've abolished a lot of Piyutim. Go on Yom Tisha B'Av. I've said this also many times. They pick out 10, 15 kinos and they'll say them, and they'll talk about them, and the rest they don't say. But that's not the way it was in the traditional shul. These early proto-reformers were saying that the people are not paying attention. They're becoming bored. So let us get rid of some piyutim. Today, lots of shuls have gotten rid of yotzros and piyutim and all sorts of things. But in those days, no. This is what you have to do. And if you're bored, so you sit there, and you sit there bored. What the Maskilim said is that these prayers are not understood by anyone, and they don't add anything to the service. Already Ibn Ezra had criticized Kalir, for no one could understand what he was saying. And that's true. So there could be a value to saying things if you don't understand it. But the Maskilim were saying no. If you think for a minute, though, if you take our Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur services, davening, if you got rid of all the piyutim and got rid of all the medieval stuff, it wouldn't take very long. The Rambam had a very short high holiday service. So in the last years of the 18th century, you begin to see attempts at reforming, real reform, various parts of the synagogue service, not only in Germany, but also in France. I would say many of these are reforms with a small r, as opposed to reforms with big r. After all, if you take out a piyut here and there, if you take out Yikum Purkan, I don't think anyone's going to say if you take out Yikum Purkan, that's a reform with a capital R. We will see soon reforms with a capital R. That is halachically problematic and absolutely forbidden reforms. But right now, we're still talking about reforms that could be justified and in certain places would be adopted. We'll see later on, because I think I have to carry this through all the way. We'll deal with Shem Shor Hirsch. He gets rid of Kol Nidre when he was rabbi of Oldenburg. Then he puts it back in. And we have other examples as well. Now, these attempts at the end of the 18th century to get rid of certain prayers didn't have much influence. So I want to skip them and focus on how reform bursts on the scene in the early 19th century, because it's that which creates the great dispute, the major international battle that breaks out about reform. Is reform ever permissible? What is permissible? And then we're going to see the fascinating point that reform could be permissible, but only if the rabbis are doing it. If these people are doing it and we know that they're not good Jews, then by definition, we can't agree with it. And from the early 19th century, the battle lines are drawn. It's from then that we can date the origin of Orthodox polemics, even of orthodoxy. The whole idea of orthodoxy exists in opposition to reform. You can only speak about the concept of orthodoxy when there's reform. Before that, it's just traditional Judaism. And yet a traditional shul that everyone went to, some are more observant, some are less observant. Think the Sephardic world. But once you have an actual movement advocating reform and you have a counter movement that's advocating upholding the tradition. And not only is it advocating upholding the tradition, we'll see that's advocating even more than simply upholding the tradition, because in response to the new reform, you have to do more. Then you can speak about orthodoxy. And then that's when reform begins. Reform with a capital R that continues to this day, although many, many changes. Okay. So let's go back to Berlin. Early 19th century, approximately 3,500 Jews living in Berlin. I hope to go to Berlin. this summer. I've got to do this summer because my Stolperstein for Rabbi Weinberg, I still haven't seen it yet. We were supposed to have a huge thing with the rabbinical seminary there in 2020 in June, and it had to be canceled because of COVID. So I don't know if we're going to do a big thing, but I definitely want to go see it. And every time I walk in Berlin, I relive these disputes. You can go there now. You can see Mendelssohn's grave. One day we'll do a trip again. The whole cemetery was destroyed, not by the Nazis. Again, they left cemeteries for this odd reason, by the communists. But we do have, at least we have a Matzeva. It doesn't mean he's buried right there. Well, in the first two decades of the 19th century, you have approximately 3,500 Jews living in Berlin. And there is one main show. Private service, you couldn't have private minyan. Private minyanim were prohibited. And that was the standard and standard way that Jews have lived throughout the generations. On the other hand, we do know that there's a number of, there were approximately a dozen minyanim that were illegal, but no one was enforcing it, so no one cared. So, but technically they weren't allowed to, it's not like in Altona, where Rav Yaakov Emden was given permission to have a private minyan, and he was very proud of that. No, these were minyanim, not official minyanim. We know that because of the secularization, the turn away from religion, the main shul, the big shul, was usually empty. Very few people went to it. Now, Mendelssohn had always advocated keeping the traditional practice with cultural integration. But now, generation or two later, people want cultural integration. What they don't want is the tradition. And instead, their sentiments are not of sentiments of connecting to halacha or of Torah, but rather they're connecting to Germany, which now they can be part of Germany. They're allowed to move out of the ghetto and be part of it, of modern Europe. In the early 1800s, we see the first reform services, and we can use those terms. And the very two first ones, one is founded by this man, Israel Jacobson, who was a businessman, because of his activities for reform, he's, as it says, considered one of the heralds of Reform Judaism. There's another individual we'll talk about, David Friedlander. We'll see more about him in a little bit. You can see their dates. So getting back to Jacobson, in the town of Ziessen, S-E-E-S-E-N, Westphalia, Jacobson builds a synagogue there, which he calls a temple. This is the first example of a synagogue called the temple. Now, we don't have any contemporaneous evidence that says that the reason he called it a temple was to take the place of the temple in Jerusalem, but that seems to make the most sense. And we know that after this, lots of synagogues began to be called temples, and they did not believe in return to the Israel. So it makes sense that, and later generations definitely saw temple as taking the place of the temple, because we have our local temple. We don't need that temple over there in Jerusalem that was not going to be rebuilt anyway. But we don't see that from the beginning. Why else would you call it temple? I'm assuming it has to be it. Incidentally, there were conservative synagogues also start calling themselves temples in America, but there are Orthodox synagogues that call themselves temples also. In the 20th century, and I have a list of a few Orthodox temples, why an Orthodox synagogue out west. You can look in that book I put online by Harold Sharfman my blog post, the last one, in which he has some great pictures, and he has pictures of the synagogue his father served, an Orthodox synagogue that called himself temple. I think what it is, if you're in wherever he was, Kansas or Iowa or something, you want the non-Jews know that this is the Jewish place, so you call it a temple. I think that's probably why. But you did have Orthodox synagogue called temple. So his temple, his synagogue, he puts a bell tower on top, if you can believe that. obviously a Christian element. And as far as I know, only one later German synagogue has a bell tower. In the inside of the synagogue in Ziessen, they move the bima from its traditional position, which is in the middle, and move it closer to the ark. This is a clear imitation of how churches look, where they have the altar up in the front. And you can see that if you come with me this summer, you'll see in the Doani Synagogue in Italy. We'll also go, God willing, to Italy this summer. You'll see where in the old Italian synagogues, they also move the bima to the front, influenced by Christianity. They also put in the synagogue in Zisson, and you can see this as well in the Dohany Synagogue in Budapest, a raised pulpit to give sermons. Like you've probably seen pictures and things where the priest or the bishop goes up, he walks up on top and he looks down at the community. I've never, other than the Dohany Synagogue, I've never seen an Orthodox synagogue that has, I've never seen an Orthodox, it's not an Orthodox synagogue. Other than Dohany, I've never seen a synagogue that has it. In fact, in Dohany, those who've been with me probably recall, there's two raised pulpits because they had two rabbis there and the rabbis couldn't get along with each other. So, and one Shabbos, one rabbi would give the drasha, the other Shabbos, the other rabbi would give the drasha, and they built two separate pulpits, so each one would have their pulpit. And one of these rabbis who couldn't get along with the other one, his name was Hevesy. He's the grandfather of Alan Hevesy, who was city controller of New York, intermarried, then did time in the big house, unfortunately. But his grandfather was the neologue co-chief rabbi of Budapest. And when I say neologue, he's a Shomer Shabbos, kosher, the whole bit. We're not dealing with reformers here. They're like right-wing conservative. So further in the synagogue in Zisson, there are Latin inscriptions adorning the building in addition to the Hebrew ones. There's an organ in the synagogue. I'm assuming a non-Jew played the organ, although I don't know of any evidence. Later on, we'll see that become standard. And women sat in the balcony. So this is the first Reform synagogue by Jacobson and Zisson. And women are sitting in the balcony. Women, I've said it before, let's see how many remember. What is the first synagogue in Jewish history, world history, that men and women sit together? Who's going to type it in? I'll keep talking and see who can type it in. And I'll give you a hint. The Rabbi Kelman, but it's like when you have these contests.
I apologize. I should have done that.
Anyone who is associated with ABC television cannot participate in the contest. So, but yes, absolutely correct. It's in Albany, Isaac Mayer Wise. Until World War I, even in Germany, men and women sat together. Until World War I, men and women sat separately. And that's how the churches were. Only in Weimar, that is after World War I, the Weimar period, was mixed seating introduced into synagogues in Germany. Now, they did remove the machitza in Germany before Weimar. And in some cases, the women came down from the balcony, but they didn't sit with men. They sat separately on the same level. And as Rabbi, you said Albany, but who introduced it? Isaac Mayer Wise. There's a lot. It was controversial, and there's a lot written on this. And churches, as I said, also didn't have mixed use. Now, the Bima, the placement of the Bima, doesn't become such a huge issue in Germany. It's not as it does in Hungary. I mean, in Germany, they also recognize it's inappropriate, but Hungary, this becomes such a central thing. When we get to how Hungary deals with reform, the Gedolim, or many of the Gedolim, because not all of them signed on, said you can't even step foot into a synagogue if the Bima is not in the middle. And we'll see what Moshe Feinstein has to say about that. Now, we have an eyewitness report of the opening of the temple in Zisson in 1810. And you can find this eyewitness report. Gunter Plaut has two volumes of primary texts of the Reform movement. One focuses on America, the other focuses on Europe. And if you look in there, you can, and I printed it out, talks about how, first of all, in the dedication of the temple, the eyewitness reports that Christians who were in attendance, nothing wrong with that, but they join in the singing. And it ends on a universalistic theme. Here it is. The festivities were original and unique. Where would one have seen a similar day on which Jews and Christians celebrated together in a common service in the presence of more than 40 clergymen of both religions and then sat down to eat and rejoice together in intimate company? I'm assuming what they were eating wasn't kosher. Jacobson says as follows, it's not been my intent to bring about a complete religious unification of all religions. He says that I don't want a unification of the religions. And in Plaut's introduction, he cites this as proof that that Jacobson was not interested in religious assimilation. He was interested in reform, but not religious assimilation. But if you look at his next words, that is Jacobson's next words, after saying that it's not my intent to bring about a complete religious unification of all religions, he says as follows, One accomplishes nothing at all if one desires everything or too much at one time. What is needed is gradual and slow development. So I'm reading it. It seems to be saying that religious unification is not ipso facto wrong, but in today's day and age, it's not something we can do. But in the future, this could be a goal. I guess when the Christians get rid of their belief in Jesus, you know, then we can all be worshiping the divine together. What I will pick up with next class, I see it's already just about 9:30, is Jacobson's going to tell us what's driving him. And then we're going to get into a very interesting tangent, because Jacobson is going to make the argument that it's vital that our religious service not be disgraceful, not for us only, but in the eyes of our neighbors. And I think most people today, if you told them this, they'd say, the idea that we're going to determine what our shul service looks like based upon what the Goyim think, that's not a normal way of looking at it. That's a classical reform way of looking at it. And you will see, I'm going to cite you Rishonim and Acharonim, who believe it or not say the exact same thing, that our synagogue service has to be, cannot be a Chil Hashem. The very concept that a synagogue service could be a Chil Hashem in the eyes of the Goyim. And then we'll move on to, Friedlander and... Well, lots of good stuff coming up. But let me make a note here. Let me take the questions, lots of questions. Someone asked privately, last week I spoke about it, maybe permitted for a Kohen to go to the funeral of a non-Jew. Sometimes a person could have been Jewish, but may not have been aware of it, someone says. Yeah, it's possible, but generally we don't make that assumption. The Gemara already deals with that. Someone could be descended from the 12 tribes, the 10 tribes. You could always have a suffix, but unless you know otherwise, if you know that someone's a Christian, that you know, you can assume that. After all, we do much more important things than going to funerals. I mean, we use non-Jews as a Shabbos guy. And there have been some cases. There was a case in Israel, supposedly, where the Shabbos guy, turns out he was a Russian, turns out he was actually Jewish. They thought he wasn't Jewish. But they have crazy cases like that. But generally, we have a concept of a Shabbos guy, and we don't worry that maybe four generations ago, his maternal grandmother was Jewish. Naftali tells us Rabbi Oras also taught YUJSS. He did. He's actually the translator of some of you probably know that red volume of Tanakh, Judaica Press, which is a translation of all the Rashis on Tanakh and a selection of commentaries. The very first one that came out in the 70s, I guess it is, on Sefer Yehoshua, that was done by Rabbi Oras. And Ruth says, Oras taught Esther Schoenfeld. Well, I don't even know what Esther Schoenfeld is. I guess it's a school, but I never heard of it. So someone privately points out in the Torah, Sota is spelled with a sin. You seem to imply there was a Samach. Well, and then you say, by the time of Chazal, no difference in pronunciation, all got written as Samach. The Chazal writes it as a Samach. The Rambam still writes it as a sin. You know, the word Sata, sin tet, hey. Why there was a change, I always thought because they sounded the same, so it didn't really matter. But I don't know why they weren't mocked on it. Someone, Sprinza, says that Islam was not considered idolatry of monotheistic Christianity because of the Trinity is considered, it's questionable as a monotheistic religion. Yes, so you say that may be a difference in why the Muranos were okay to convert and be secret Jews. No, I don't understand, because the Muranos were converting to Christianity, not to Islam. It's the same thing that the Muranos were speaking about, or conversos. They were dealing with Christianity, both in France and Germany, as well as in Spain and Portugal. It is the case that there was an earlier forced conversions in the Rambam's day of the Almohads. But that's Sprinza.
Yeah, what I was saying is that. Many of the Muslims didn't consider it, many of the Jews didn't consider it the same as in conversion the same, because they're converting to
Christianity,
a monotheistic religion.
Yes, like absolutely. Absolutely. That's absolutely the case. But the thing is, we're speaking about in the end of the 14th century and the 15th century, where you have mass conversions of Jews to Christianity in Spain. And then with the expulsion, you have, I mean, the numbers are unbelievable. In fact, it seems that more Jews, or at least this is the claim by Norman Roth, and even people don't agree with him, know it's massive numbers. Norman Roth thinks that the majority of Jews converted to Christianity in Spain from 1391 on. And now there we're dealing with Christianity. So the question remains, why, when it came to Christianity in Spain and Portugal, do we not have the martyrdom that we have in the Christian lands of Germany and England and France? So that will have to hold off to our nice bus trips, where we go into great detail and we deal with the great disputes between the two Roths, Norman Roth and Cecil Roth. And Norman Roth's allies include Benzio Netanyahu and others, and Cecil Roth's allies, we have fun. Michael says the Messiah. Oh no, we got to that. Susanna says, "Well, Aramaic found its way into the center because that's what people understood." I'm not sure what
the vernacular. So there was a time when Aramaic was the vernacular, and
we have vernacular for the women in particular. Aramaic, that was not just for the women. We have it to this day in the Siddur, Brich Shmei, and all other things that are Aramaic. In theory, we'll see there's nothing wrong with vernacular. It's Chazal tell us there's nothing wrong with it. The problem that the Gedolim had is how to say that it's wrong when the Gemara, when Chazal tell us that it's permissible. That's going to be one of the most difficult things that the Gedolim have to do, because when the Reformers are going to say that we want to pray in the vernacular and the rabbis are going to say you can't, how can you say you can't when the Rambam is explicit, feel the Choloshon and the Gemara, etc. Ellie says that my kids live in Berlin, in Kira for Lauder, started a new community based on old and wonderful place and growing. I don't know if that's related. I think that's related to what you're referring to is the Rabbiner seminar, the Adas Yisrael there in Berlin. We, on our trip there, we ate there, and I've been there a few different times, and that is the community. There is a Chabad community, Rabbi Techtal, but the non-Chabad, it's a community. We were there. We saw the nursery. There's lots of little kids playing, speaking German. But this is the Shomer Shabbos community of young people and, you know, working people. And there's people, not just yeshivish people, but regular people. And it's a very, very nice community. And yes, you can please make the connection to your son-in-law. I'd love to, because when I go back to Germany, I'll be traveling around again. And he's official rabbi of a German state. I assume he's a musmach of the Rabbiner seminar. When we go on our Germany trip, we also eat with one of the rabbis who come from there.
Yes, he was the second graduating class.
Ah, so very good. Rabbi Shudnow says the term orthodoxy came from reform, used for them as a characterization against traditionalists, not a respected term. That's what Hirsch says, that it was a negative term, use a term. We'll get to that. But it's been accepted. It's not the only such term. I've said it already in the past. The term misnagdim was a term used by the Hasidim, and yet the Hasidim were used against the non-Hasidim, but it was the Hasidim who were more the misnagdim. But we have that we have lots of examples of that where people pick terms. The term queer used to be a negative term, and then you take a term and you can... use it, and that gets rid of the negativity. M.H. Lazerson, am I saying that the concept of kavon and ruach may have links to maskilin? No, I'm not saying the concept of kavana and ruach. I'm saying the idea that you are a spiritually uplifted person, the way we think of it, and that you're religiously inspired. Look, I guess it is the same as kavana, but that's not what they meant. They meant that you come out religiously inspired. So in theory, we're supposed to. You're right. I would say this is one of the examples where they were onto something here, that we are. But we all know that if it happens a few times a year or on Rosh Hashanah, it's not something when it's routine. See, that's the old issue of tefillah as routinization. Hasidus had to deal with this. If tefillah is something that you do constantly, because by rules, originally it didn't have to be rules, but then they made it routine that you have to do it because people couldn't pray on their own Rambam tells us. But then whenever you have a routine, what suffers is the spontaneity and the spirituality. So it's always a struggle. What the Maskilim were saying is that we do not have this anymore, and therefore let's try to bring it back. And how do you bring it back? Well, you bring it back with a choir, you bring it back with an inspiring sermon. All these ways we're supposed to bring it back. And yes, the Italians call their synagogue temples, but since when do they start calling it temples? I believe that this is only a recent thing. The synagogue, for example, in Rome is called a temple, but this is taken from the reformers. The Italian synagogues, if you walk into the Italian synagogues, you could feel like you're in a church. They were designed just like a church. And those who listened to my interview with Rabbi Desani will recall I asked him what he thinks about the organs that they played. And he didn't mince any words. He says, that came from the Christians. And there you say, the Florentine synagogue is almost a replica of the Catholic Church. Yes, the Florentine synagogue has a raised pulpit. That's right. Thank you for reminding me. Not only does it have a raised pulpit, the rabbi uses the raised pulpit when he speaks. In the Florentine synagogue, they move the bima to the middle. It used to not be in the middle. They moved it to the middle. But the rabbi still goes up and speaks from the pulpit. The synagogue in Verona still has the bima in the front, as they all used to have in the front. Oh, and Rabbi Yellen says, Borough Park at Temple Bethel, large Orthodox show. Yes, indeed. But so Azerson tells us that the rabbis do not use the pulpit most recently. Most of them do not use it because of the long staircase. I can tell you that the last time we were in Italy, and that was, they had a new rabbi. Now he's gone, they have a different new rabbi. He used the pulpit. But the previous one, Rabbi Levy, who was there for many years, every time I heard him speak, he did not use the pulpit. I want to use it. It looks fun to go up there, but it always has a marker. I mean, a block, it has like a thing there, like a belt, so you can't get up. But if no one's there one day, I want to walk up. And Rabbi Shudnow says, thank you. In Marseille, the rabbi spoke from above. Rivka says, when speaking Hungarian, religious Hungarian Jews refer to Shul as the temple. Which religious Hungarian Jews? I've been with a lot of Hungarian Jews. I've never heard them refer to the synagogue as a temple.
Yes, unless it is.
Unless these are Neologue Jews.
No. It's called, that's the word for synagogue in Hungarian.
Okay, when they're speaking Hungarian. Okay.
Right.
Okay.
I speak Hungarian.
Ellie says, the Jewish center in Manhattan doesn't have the beam in the center. I'm trying to think back, but it's not in the front. I mean, yes. It's sort of in the front, but it's not in the Wayway front. That is,
yes, it is.
When
yes,
they have, no, the Wayway front would be up by the Bima. It's back. It's pushed back.
No, I go there every week. I know the shul.
Yeah, you know, I went there also when I lived there. I'm talking, it's not on the Bima. It's, well, I guess,
it's right in front of the
Right in front of it. Okay. I'm trying to think back now when I haven't been there in a number of years. Okay, I take your word for it. I thought that it was pushed back a little. No. I mean, a lot of shuls have it right in front where they do Pesukah de Zimra, and then they have something in the middle. I haven't been to the Jewish Center in over 20 years. So if you go to Venice, you also see it. You see there were Sephardic shuls that were like this where there they have it, in the back. The bima's in the back and the aron's in the front. But you also, we'll get to it when we deal with it. The Rav Yosef Karo, the Kesef Mishnah on the Rambam says explicitly, there's no such concept that you have to have the bima. You can have the bima wherever you want, wherever people hear best. But it becomes a matter of importance in the Ashkenazic world precisely because the reformers were imitating the churches to do it that way. And therefore, it becomes important. So Rav Moshe Feinstein will say, we'll get back to this, but Rav Moshe will say that in America, it's not an issue. You don't need to be concerned about church shows like the Jewish Center because it doesn't apply anymore because we're not fighting the reformers who are making it that the central thing. And the reason that these synagogues have it has nothing to do with the churches. So Rav Moshe says it's not an issue anymore. But the Hungarians think it's a big issue to this day.
Because of the Chasam Sofer.
Yes, exactly. We'll get to it all. Gershon says, was the raised pulpit opposing the paradoxical concept of the Yoreh Lifnei HaTeiva? I have heard that concept. No. It's just that that's what the churches used to do. And Tali says the base Knesset in Würzburg do not have Bima in center. Yeah, and that's a big issue. When we get to the classes on Rabbi Bamberger, he could not fix that. That's one thing he wanted to fix. So we'll deal with that. And Rabbi Kelman says in the early 20th century, a reformed temple in Germany was offered about $1 million on the condition they had mixed seating, and they turned it down. Shuna says the base of Migash only had separation of Sils based on Shueva. Didn't early synagogues, iPad says, during the late Second Temple times have mixed seating? It seems so, although it's not clear exactly what they did in these synagogues. Were these places, you know, davening wasn't, they did have davening, but the, you know, davening wasn't the same. You had the Beis Hamikdash where you had sacrifices, could be mostly where they learned there. I don't know. It does seem the archaeologists do think that Sperber has something on this also, that they did have mixed seating, but subsequent to that, the halacha is you don't. And someone points out that the savannah, the synagogue, looks like a church. In the 19th century in Warsaw, Dasa says, a synagogue called the German synagogue. Yeah, that would have been the more modern synagogue, just like you have a choral synagogue. But remember, these synagogues did not have mixed seating. What made them more reformist is, and we're going to learn about one of these reform rabbis who's assassinated. He's a reform rabbi in one of these sort of synagogues in Poland. It's that they had a choir. It's that they had a sermon in vernacular. There was never mixed seating in any of these shuls. Quickly, let me just get the last couple things. Ruth says that the West End shul in Frankfurt today is Orthodox, but the pre-war congregation is Reform. The organ is still up in the balcony where the women sat. And there's a very large section in front with a table that isn't used. The rabbi sits near the table. You find similar things. You see it in Venice. You see it in Rome. If you go in Rome, the organ is behind the the Aron Kodesh. Thank you very much. Just quickly. Finally, Esther Schoenfeld was on the Lower East Side. I didn't know that. Okay, there's lots of more comments. I think we'll end it here. I'll end. Esther says, Ellie says, my Oberlander family will not enter a shul where the bima is not in the middle. That is true. You can, Rabbi Professor Lyman, he has tapes of him going on a trip to Budapest, and he's explaining all the about the Dohani synagogue, and he says real Hungarians won't enter it. So if any of you are Oberlanders, you can stay out here while we go inside. The last thing, someone privately says regarding Kohanim going to funerals of non-Jews, a Kohen shouldn't come into contact with a dead animal's corpse. By saying that a Kohen can attend a Gentile's funeral, it implies that non-Jews are not really human beings, etc., etc. I'd like to know where it says that Kohanim can't come into contact with a dead animal's corpse. We dealt with that last semester about Kohen and the Sheretz. But again, this isn't coming into contact with... You can't go in the base today. I'm talking about today, not in temple times or anything. But you can't go in the base of Migdash. I mean, you can't, we're not talking about touching anyway. We're talking about being in the same room. A Kohen cannot touch a non-Jew. That's not the issue. The issue is being in the same room. Today, we don't have Tumah with a Kohen anyway. So it's, but we, for the base of Migdash, but, okay, there's a lot here. I can't answer all the comments or questions now because it's taking us pretty long. But Rabbi Kelman, yeah.
Okay, thank you. All right, Dr. Mark will be back Wednesday interviewing Chaim Ishkashish from Greece. He's quite a character also. He's the one who leads our tours in Greece, our local on the ground in Greece. So that will be this Wednesday at 2 p.m. Before that, tomorrow we have a triple header. Aaron Kohler will kick us off at 9:30 in the morning with part three in a series on Megillat Esther. Rachel Sharansky Danziger at 11 a.m. on the ins and outs of liberty going through Sefer Shmot. And at 1 p.m., Alex Israel continuing his series on Eliyahu Prophet Affairs. So there's three classes tomorrow. And then, like I say, Wednesday, the communities around the world will be in Greece. So it's should be a fascinating interview. And we look forward to learning you. And please invite your friends the rest of the week, all our regular classes. And thank you, everybody. Laila Tov, and everybody be well. Thank you very much.
Thank you. All the best.
Thank you. All the best. Okay. Hope all is well in California.
Thank God. All good.
Okay, good. Okay. And yes, Hungary, listen, Rav David Lifshitz and YU wouldn't, from what I understand, wouldn't be Masada Kiddushin inside a shul. I don't know if don't be Mandiam. That was another thing of the Hungarians, right? You couldn't make a wedding in a shul, couldn't have a round shul, all kinds of the rules they made in 1869. But yes, yes.
The Hungarians were a little crazy. They still are.
They had an extreme view. Listen, that's, the battles with reform, yes, undoubtedly, they were quite the, they were the most extreme in their response.
I dealt with myself with Hungarian.
But anyways, but that's the way it could be. Yes, but you go to the shuls, the rules they had, I mean, listen, our shuls would be considered reform. Any shul that has a sermon by the rabbi would be considered by Hungarians forbidden to walk into, for sure. Would be no different than any than Temple Emmanuel in their eyes. But anyways, okay, everybody. Laila Tov, everybody be well. Nice to see you. We look forward to seeing you soon again.